Hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast, episode 217. I am your host, Rob Cope, and today we're talking to Fergus McCready. Before we start the interview, let's have a listen to Fergus's track, Forest Floor. This is from his album, also named Forest Floor, which came out last year, 2022. Mr. Fergus McCready, welcome to the Jazz Podcast. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks very much for having me.
Ah, it's our pleasure. This one's been a long time coming. I've wanted to talk to you, sir, and our listeners have been clamoring for this for a long time. So here we are. Fergus, tell us a little bit about yourself for our lovely listeners who may not know your music already.
Oh, yeah, of course. So my name is Fergus McCready, and I play piano and I'm a jazz pianist, and I live in Scotland, in Glasgow. I'm from Clackmannanshire, kind of near the Ochil Hills, and then I grew up there, moved to Glasgow to be a musician, and have my own trio. We've put out 3 records so far, and what I think I like to do most is play jazz, combining that jazz sound with Scottish traditional music as well. I grew up loving traditional music and playing it a little bit as well on pipes, and I think that sound is kind of what's been my main career thing so far, for sure.
Wow, what a brilliant summary. That was so fast. That
trying to be not too waffly, I suppose.
Smashed it. I'm the king of waffling. I can't help myself.
We can balance each other out in this podcast.
So, Fergus, we are here also to talk about your gig at the North Sea Jazz Festival this summer. This is big news. You have lots of big news because also you were nominated for the Mercury Awards this year with your trio.
Mm, last year, that's right. Yeah,
stunning. That is absolutely stunning. Very sought after. Opportunity that one is. So we'll come to that in a minute. Let's talk about the North Sea Jazz Festival. How did this come about? And when are you playing? Do you know any details of the gig?
The only detail that I know is that we're on the Friday.
Cool.
That's all I can remember. That's all I can remember off the top of my head. I know there's so many other good gigs on. If I wasn't playing, I would go and see something else when I was playing for sure. Yeah, it just came about. I know one of the guys who kind of books the festival. I've met him a few times, first at Jazz Ahead, I think, last year. And then through my record label, they kind of coordinated with him to set us up with some Netherlands gigs earlier this year. Oh, no, that would have been last year, actually, in December, just gone. So we played like Amsterdam and Rotterdam and Tilburg kind of under his umbrella a little bit. And I think that, because of that, it just kind of came to be that he asked us to do North Sea as well, which is really cool. So it's not a tremendously exciting story necessarily, but that's how it came about.
It's really interesting to know how these things do come about, because there are so many different ways of going about trying to get a gig at the festival, or you know, book a tour manager or be on a label. Now, my wife told me that she'd heard a story that you had gotten on Edition Records by handwriting a letter and posting them as CD. Is that true?
It's actually true, yeah.
It's actually true. It's like, would I lie to you? That one we were like
have spun out the lie a bit more. It's true. That is true. I think I was trying to, because I mean, Dave, it's such a great team. I really like Dave Edition, and everyone who works there is really nice. But I think when I was, I released my first record, and I did that myself, and I really wanted to do my second record on a label that felt like kind of the right step. And it kind of, through the research that I'd done, it really felt like Edition was the one that I really wanted to get on, that felt like the right sort of career move. So I wanted to do something that was, because Dave must get so much stuff sent to him, I think, and you want to kind of be able to stand out. Like, the key thing with pitching people is like doing something that they're going to remember, or that's going to make them go, oh, I should actually listen to this. So I think just writing him an email with whatever was like a Dropbox link attached to it, I wanted to do something that was a bit more interesting. So yeah, I like hand wrote a letter, and I burnt a CD with some like just some tracks of us playing in a rehearsal room or something, put it in an envelope and sent it, and the rest is history. So that was probably stunning. Was about a year before we actually made the signing, I think.
That's incredible. It's very bold to send someone a CD, because it's a bit like Marmite. Some people love them and will only listen to them. Some people will like frisbee it out the window and announce that you're a dinosaur for using them.
Yeah, it's so true. And I think, you know, if I was in the same situation now, I don't know if I would actually do that, because I think even in the past couple of years, CDs have become even more obsolete. I mean, people still listen to CDs, but I mean, I personally almost never listen to CDs. I use vinyl. Or if in the car, I used Spotify, you know. So would I do that now? Not necessarily. But I think at the time, CDs were still a bit more of a thing. So
it's funny when you look back on things you did when you were younger, I think, as well, that you've like some, I don't know, I get this sense that like it's a different person, you know, some things like that where I've done where I'm like, that's brilliant. I don't know if I do that now.
But yeah.
Hey,
that's so true. Yeah, that is a funny thing. I'm really... I think as a like musician, I mean, are you always trying to capture something in your music other than just play the notes? And that's something that definitely I'm very interested in, like nostalgia and looking back at like the past, like who you or what this, like who you were, or who this person was, or what this place used to be, or whatever. It's I find that very interesting personally, like how that makes someone feel. But yeah, and as a musician, like that's such a, it's particularly jazz, like. I think maybe it was Coltrane. He used to describe it as like every album is like a chapter in your sort of musical development or whatever. And it's quite an interesting. I think that's quite an interesting thing. Like, yeah, everyone sort of develops over time, and you're a different player and a person all the time. Yeah, I just think that's interesting. Maybe it's a bit too early in the podcast to get into the really deep stuff.
No, I agree. I think it's really important for your listenership and your fans to be able to see the evolution of your music. You know, if you're kind of waiting forever until you do one perfectly polished thing, it doesn't have the same context if you can't go back and listen to the journey along the way.
Yeah, for sure, definitely. Yes, it's interesting when you listen to like the very first album that I did, it's similar in some ways, but it's definitely very different in other ways, for sure.
How do you feel you've evolved and changed? How many albums have you done now, Fergus?
We've done three, so three have come out,
right?
And there's and one recorded as well in the bag.
How many are on Edition? Is it the two. And
two. Right, okay. So the very first one was a self-release. I do like that album, actually. I think it's forgotten about a little bit, maybe because it wasn't on a label, it didn't get the same promotion, I think, but I, at the time I was very proud of it. But I mean, I think the key thing is I remember when I did my very first album, I thought a lot about the composing aspect of it. And I kind of put, I think that was the album where I really put the most effort into trying and make it the most well-composed whole, I think. So not that I haven't thought about it in the other albums, but I really wanted that album to be like a really cohesive, like sort of piece. And I kind of was thinking, oh, the playing will just take care of itself. I remember coming away from that album and thinking, oh, I'm really happy with the compositions, but I wish I'd played a little bit better, which I've wished after every album, to be fair. But yeah, I think after that, I really wanted to, I kind of had like it was a bit longer of a time before I released my next record, because I really just wanted to get into the practice room and practice all the stuff that I knew I needed to practice to feel a bit more comfortable with my playing, especially like playing in the style that I was doing. It was like, it kind of needed a bit more exploring on my part, I think. So I think every album is sort of like, there's still this similar thing that I'm kind of looking for, but almost, at least compositionally anyway, but it's like gets slightly more I think my playing is a little bit more like tight and not polished is the wrong word. That makes it kind of sound boring, doesn't it? But I think it gets a little bit more cohesive every time, just like the way I'm kind of coming with the phrase, because it's so improvisatory, way the phrases are coming out. And I think I'm getting, you're sort of trying to do more research as well. I'm getting more wise about how to play jazz really authentically, or how to play traditional music really authentically, you know. And even now, I just did this fourth album, which isn't out yet, but I did that 2 months ago. And I'm listening to that now, I'm like, oh, I wish I could just do that now, because I could do like a slightly better job now. So it's like a constant development. But I think the playing is the thing that has evolved the most. Also with the other three, like, we've got much tighter as a band, I think, by playing lots of gigs. So that's what I would say.
Wow. So who are the band? Who else is in the group?
Yeah, so it's David Bowden is the bass player. Originally from London, but he's lived in Glasgow for probably about 10 years now. And Stephen Henderson is the drummer from Air. Two really, really high quality musicians. Really great.
How did you meet these two?
We're just at college together, really. When I was at college, there weren't that many piano players for whatever reason. So I did a lot of people's other stuff, and people really liked playing with the two of them together. They've always fit really well as like a combo. So I just ended up playing with them all the time. And eventually I think it was an Edinburgh Jazz Festival gig, or maybe I think it was even a Glasgow Jazz Festival gig. And they just got in touch and said, do you want to put on a gig? You can do what you want. I thought, I really want to do a trio. And they seemed like the obvious choice at the time. And then I've just never really felt the need to replace them. So.
There's a funny sort of, what's the word? When you're not spoiled for choice, like I felt like at college in Manchester, the people that I knew who were also into jazz and improvising, you like clung to them like they were life vests, because there wasn't loads of people around, you know, and we kind of taught each other a lot. Is that something you found you went through in your experience?
With the other two, I mean, definitely, I think a lot of like the way I play is kind of informed by having played. I mean, I've not played with anyone as much as I've played with them. There are some other people I've played with a lot too, but I think, you know, whenever I'm like, maybe it's more of a writing thing than a playing thing necessarily, but I think whenever I'm writing now, it's almost like, how would Stephen, or I'm going to call him Hendo now, because I always call him Hendo. How would Hendo play that? Would Hendo sound good at that? Or how would Dave play this baseline? You know, I'm kind of relating it to them, because I think actually, even though it's my name on the thing, they've kind of defined a lot of what the past three albums have sounded like. I think they're kind of equally important in a lot of ways. I've just learned a lot from them in terms of writing for the musicians that you really know, and getting to like play with musicians a lot. And I suppose they're very good as well at not taking it too seriously. There, maybe I've sometimes like I'm a bit like sort of very focused, and I would have a tendency to take the gigging too seriously. Whereas they're good at like, you know, just being relaxed, and I find them very relaxing to be around for that reason.
It's good to have a balance. Get some people to, you know, if everyone were the same, it wouldn't be very interesting.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, yeah, the three of us are quite different, but in a way that works for sure. I have really good friends as well. I mean, David is actually getting married in 2 weeks from the point of recording this podcast. Me and Hendo are on best men duties. So it's quite a cool like partnership, and that musically worked well together as well. And we're also just, you know, good friends. So
that's wonderful. I think an audience can sense that on a gig as well. Is that, do you feel like you'd like use that to your advantage, having such a genuine relationship?
Well, it would be slightly, it would give me slight sociopath vibes maybe if I was using that to sell the gigs. I think it's just something that's natural, really. I mean, I think playing music with other people, you can't, it's like, especially if you play with people a lot, it's like quite a, especially improvising, it's actually quite a vulnerable thing to do, because playing in front of people is scary. It always is scary, and it gets less scary as time goes on, especially if you're playing with people you know. But you can't help but form, like, even if you don't necessarily get on with the other person or like that person that you're playing with a lot that much, you still eventually end up like forming something with them because it is such a communal thing to play music together. It sort of like creates friendships within weird ways. Like everyone in the scene and everyone that I kind of play with and stuff, I wouldn't say I'm necessarily similar to that many people, but I really get on with a lot of them because we play music together, and I think that creates quite a nice brotherhood, so to speak. Yeah,
such a good point. I've recorded with people that I don't really like, but like as people, we're not friends. We don't talk. I don't like them. I'm not super mean. I like everyone. But you know, there's one or two people in the world I can think of who they're so good that when we start playing, I'm like, you're like my best friend in the world. You know, when the music is happening, it's like something incredible. It's like, I don't need to have like a really close personal relationship. I do, you know, usually it's nice to play with your friends, but there are some instances, you're so right, where it like creates something else playing with people. Yeah.
And you quite often, I think, if you do play with someone, say someone like really annoys you before a gig, like they're late or they just are rude or you whatever, someone annoys you before the gig. This hasn't happened to me very often, to be fair, but it has happened in the past. And you're annoyed at the person. And then you play the gig with them and you're suddenly like, oh, but it's fine. I actually like this person. They like it. It's kind of a weird thing where playing music with people does change really how you see them, especially in the moment and especially after the gig. I think because it is such an intense, charged experience, you know.
Agree. Very intense and incredibly fun. And I'm still like in the honeymoon period of COVID's over, we can all go outside again, even though it's been like 2 years now, you know. I'm still like, it's still sort of, I don't know, I think maybe the words are that I have an appreciation like never before, I suppose, you know, chance to play to an audience. Have you ever played at North Sea before?
No, this is the I've never even been before. This is the very first time.
Oh, this is incredible. Trying to think, I've seen some really great videos of it. Just random gigs. I might go and have a look afterwards, get on YouTube and see what I can find. Tell us about Addition. How much has that changed and helped your path, do you think, having gotten on? Oh, yeah. What I'll say to our listeners quickly about Addition is they're arguably the biggest jazz label in the UK and one of the most prominent ones, I suspect, globally. Because they have, amongst others, like Chris Potter, who's, you know, probably one of the best living saxophone players, technically speaking, the greatest saxophone player who's ever lived. That man can do everything.
It's crazy.
So, yeah, it's pretty great to be in his company. This is awesome. So yeah, tell us how it's changed things.
I mean, it's kind of been one of the biggest things, to be honest. Because I think releasing an album, to understand how to like sell an album well, I think as a musician, I wonder if it's almost impossible for most. I think because there's so much that goes into actually like marketing it and like creating a good strategy and thinking of like the ways to get out in the world. And you know, all the albums that I've done, I think without Addition, I don't think I would have like had that Mercury thing or this Jazz FM thing, or, you know,
what was really, the Jazz FM thing?
That was Best Instrumentalist last year.
Nice.
This like raising profile, I think that has a lot that has almost mostly to do with them. I think I have like actually a lot to thank them for, because Dave has always been great, and he's always, I think since we started working together, he's always believed in me. And yeah, I think it's kind of been one of the single most important things, really. Because like a good album can like set you a lot of the way. Because I like recording albums, but the thing I love the most is really playing live and having that live interaction with the audience. You know, that special one-off thing that doesn't happen. You're kind of always chasing that like really intense feeling that kind of comes from like playing things that could never happen again or whatever. You know, that improvisatory thing, it's harder to capture that with an album, but I do still love recording, and trying to create this like body of work is a cool thing to me. And yeah, just having people who are behind that and who are up for supporting you and know, like, kind of understand your music and know how to market it and get it to the right people who will push it to the right places. It's invaluable, actually. It makes a huge, huge difference. So yeah, all thanks to them for sure. Yeah, that's all I have to say about that, I think.
Well, it's a really hard thing, I think, as musicians. We kind of expected a little bit to be like experts in everything, you know, and it's amazing to get an expert, like someone who actually their job is to like do promotion, and then they're really good at it, and then it's like, definitely, wow, yeah, this is,
yeah,
great.
It makes a huge difference. Yeah, I can't help but sometimes like slightly disparage that fact of like, it does feel, yeah, it does, like you say, it feels like every musician now has to kind of be their own, because of, I think it has a lot to do with social media and the kind of the world that we live in. It's quite saturated and you have to be your own seller, and that's never something I've been particularly good at, to be honest, at least in my opinion anyway. So yeah, it's a bit, but then people feel like they have to do it. But yeah, it's an interesting one. It's tricky. I saw an interesting interview, don't know how much of I agree with it 100%, but I saw an interesting, maybe it was a masterclass or something, but it was Aaron Goldberg, the American pianist. He was talking about social media. He was sort of saying like, if you're like, it's a much harder to get better and to like really try and improve your craft if you're trying to sell yourself at the same time, because if you're selling yourself, you kind of need to present yourself as like a finished product. But as soon as you're telling people that you're a finished product, then it's much harder to like go off that path that you're kind of setting yourself on. So you need to like really believe in that thing. And I sometimes wonder if like young musicians, maybe even I'm in this category, but are like shortchanging themselves of much more developed they could have by like, you know, having to sell themselves from like honestly the moment that they kind of get to college. It's a tricky thing though, but you know, you kind of have to do it in other ways. And yeah, it's hard.
It is. I think about this and I talk about it all too often that, like, as an example, let's say of the early 1980s, Mike Brecker was 37 when he released his first album. Now, when we look back now, nobody thinks about that. They're just like, wow, what a body of work he's created. But now, if like anyone who waited till they were 37, you'd be labeled like out of touch, let's say. Like you say, yeah, you've got to get out of college and get on it, get releasing, get promoting.
And to me, that's such a shame, because every Michael Brecker album is like, regardless of whether you like him or not, I'm a huge fan personally, but
yeah, I am. That's like, let's go there, come on.
Perfect, let's go, let's talk about Michael Brecker. But every album is, not only is every album like really killing in terms of the playing and stuff, but it's also like, it's very him, it's like very his personality. And I think he like really found his sound and then started kind of creating that catalog. I suppose I'm talking as someone who like did their first, I did my first album when I was 19, I want to say, which is really, really young. There's part of me which is glad that I did it then, but it would have been interesting to like wait longer. So, but I don't know. Yeah. I mean, Kenny Wheeler didn't release his kind of main sort of, he didn't release New High until he was 40. I think Bill Evans was like 31 when his first album came out, maybe, or maybe it wasn't that old, but like, yeah, there's like, but nowadays it's like, what's the new, there's so much like, because the attention span feels maybe slightly shorter or whatever, it's like, what's the new thing, who's the new young cool person? And it kind of not it just puts a lot of I feel that pressure, definitely. Like it sort of feels like there's a limited window to kind of make my mark sometimes in a way, because soon I won't be the young thing anymore. So it's, yeah, it's an interesting one. It's a shame in some ways, definitely. But
I agree, because I think realistically, we're all going to peak when we're like 65 to 75, sort of, when you've got that mix of musical experience, life experience, and a lot of maturity that you can't rush that stuff, you know. But I remember going to see Chris Potter back in 2008. Chris was probably about 43 at this point, maybe younger. Maybe four, I don't know. But, you know, the Chicago Tribune had like written, I think it was them, you know, the press thing, it was like Chris Potter, the next young up and coming sax player. And at the time I was like really relieved by this, to be like, oh, he's 43 and he's young, he's up and coming. I need time.
That's the thing. Yeah. That's the thing. Like, yeah. Giving yourself time is super, super valuable. Yeah. Cause like, there's so much fun and joy to be had out of practicing and kind of finding your sound and stuff. And if you're getting limited by, if you're getting limited from doing that, that is kind of a shame, I think, sometimes, for sure.
Going back to Mike Brecker quickly, do you have a favorite album that you'd care to tell us about?
It's got to be, has to be Pilgrimage, the last one.
Yes! That, oh, that man! I obviously had prepared my answer before asking. And I said, yeah, Pilgrimage is just so special. And I love how like open it is. The tunes and the improvising feels very organic. It doesn't feel like a studio album at all.
Not all. Yeah, it's so there's so much energy. I think because like, I mean, every album is good, but like his writing on that album is so cool. Like, again, maybe it's not for everyone, but like it's very I just love how it's all like really through composed. There's like little sections that are just like really cool but never come back. Like, he obviously spent so much himself into that album, and it's kind of like tragic that it was his last one, that there's not really a better album to go out on than something that you put so much work of yourself into, you know. It's a really, really beautiful record for that reason. I think you can sort of feel in a way that he knows that this is his last record, so he kind of puts it all into it, and in the end it becomes like a really incredible record. It's the most him record for sure.
Yeah, what a great answer. I mean, I'm no expert or authority, that's the word. It just, from the feel of the music, I wholeheartedly agree. Can we talk about,
it's your favorite album as well, did you say?
Yeah, for those reasons, just the openness, the fact that all the solos feel like, even like the changes have been like thought, like this solo's right for this person in this moment, you know. It's not like the tune just blows itself all the way through. There's like exactly what you said. There's so much detail in it. There's so much like care. It's almost like looking at like contemporary classical music that just so happened to have loads of improvising in.
Totally. Yeah, totally. Some of the tunes you're waiting for like 3 or 4 minutes before you actually get to the solos, because there's so much written stuff to go through first. I think that's really, I like that.
And Quintet before it was incredible with the like 15 piece wind strings, brass ensemble that, as we've talked about lots with the kind of the pressure and development of being a jazz musician, it's nice to look back on this and be like, well, it just seems to get better and better. There's things about the first album that's incredible, but you know, the maturity and the writing just gets more and more engaged and complicated, let's say.
Absolutely. So interesting that it is. It's an amazing discography he has, because you're right, it kind of develops over time when he kind of allows himself to kind of get more complex, and you did, because his playing is always ridiculous, but yeah, like you say, the composing gets better and better as time goes on, and yeah, that's such a cool thing.
Can we talk about the bagpipes?
We can a little bit if you like. Yeah, absolutely.
I'd love to. Just, it's really interesting to think about a different instrument that you've learned, and if it's done anything different to your brain and the way you think and play as a result of it. How long did you learn them for?
I have to disclaim this by saying, because I don't want anyone who heard me play bagpipes to think I was fibbing. Because I have to disclaim and say I was terrible at the bagpipes. Not a good bagpiper at all. And I often think that, like, I think I'm, honestly, sometimes I think I'm quite a slow learner, because I've tried like a few different instruments. I've tried like learning a bit of bass as well, and my mom used to have a clarinet, so I'd learn a bit of that too. And if I think about the amount of time it actually took me to start enjoying playing the piano, it was a really long process. So I think I'm too slow a learner to learn another instrument, especially kind of now. I think I'll stick with piano. Some people seem to just be able to pick up instruments and get good at them really quickly. That, I wish I could do that, but I can't do that necessarily. But anyway, I learned them for about 5 years. The school I went to, there was actually a really quite a well-known junior pipe band there. So there was a lot of like really good pipers. And the teachers were really great. The circumstances were actually there for me to become good, but I just never did. But yeah, it's an incredible instrument though. I really, really like it.
It's very interesting. See, and I'm glad I asked, because it sort of reveals this nugget of your sort of self-opinion of being really slow as a learner. But I do think with music that perseverance and determination is a lot more important. You know, when I was at school, there was always people that were better than me. But now I'm like, well, I'm 34 and I'm still going. So I'm going to like, it's a war of attrition that I will win by default, because I'll just still be going when I'm like 70, you know.
The phrase I always tell my students is it's a marathon, not a sprint. But I actually, war of attrition is great. That's a lot more epic. I'm going to use that.
Yeah, it's just, I guess, like, there's a lot of sax players. So it's like, yeah, if I'm going to get any gigs, I've just got to outlast everybody. That's my career plan right now. It's just hang about until everyone else gives up. Inspiring,
yeah, perfect. But then when everyone else gives up, you're going to be there to take it all over.
Yes, the other way I've described my career to people in the past, I'm quite fond of this. I know it's very self-serving. Is like one of those fish that like feeds at the bottom off of all the like scraps and pebbles, you know. Quite often, like, nice. Like my friend George Millard gave me a gig a few years ago. He phoned me and was like, Rob, do you want to go to Spain for 4 days? You've only got to play for an hour. All the flights are paid for. All the hotels are paid for. My first thought was, but George, what on earth are you doing? If this is what you're palming off to me, you know, you know, it's like, never mind that. Never mind. Just like, tell me what have you got that's even better? Because I want to.
Yeah. I know. That's funny.
So, Fergus, tell us what you've got coming up. What's as well, of course, as the North Sea Jazz Festival. I'm going to look up the dates so that it seems like I'm really well prepared.
Nice.
Of course I am.
I'm coming up. Well, actually, we've just finished a sizable tour, kind of through January and February in the first half of March. That was a really, for us, a very intense period, actually. I don't know. I should have counted up the number of gigs that it actually ended up being. But honestly, the next thing that's coming up for me is a break, which I'm very excited for. I say I love to practice and I love to go hill walking. And I'm very excited to actually have some time to kind of do both of them. But after that, I mean, just various gigs kind of dotted throughout the year. Some jazz festivals are happening this summer. There's some European clubs we're doing in the kind of autumn period, and just various gigs, I think. I mean, I've got some other stuff with other bands too, so it's all on the social media and website and stuff. But it's now that the tour is done, that's been the thing that I've been focusing on the most. It's a bit more bitty, I think, like more random little bits of stuff that I'm doing. Yeah. Rather than one unified thing, but just playing and practicing and just keeping the ball rolling, I think.
Sounds fantastic. Well, the North Sea Jazz Festival is on Friday the 7th of July. That will be the day of your gig.
That's the one, yeah.
And then Saturday the 8th, Sunday the 9th in Rotterdam. And there is already published an enormous list of acts who will be... Oh, your name's just jumped out at me on the screen here.
That's great.
Yeah. I know this is
there's some amazing stuff on, some really, really amazing stuff on.
Yeah, there's I could just read the entire thing out, but that would be like, do you ever listen to the football when it's like Wigan Athletic 1-0? This guy like reads it really slowly and infuriatingly. That's always
never actually. That sounds like great listening. I want to listen to that.
Yeah, I don't know if they still do it. It used to be like at halftime on like 5 Live, you know, and they just read all the scores out. But the guy who did it was really slow. Anyway, I'm not going to do that because I don't want to recreate it. But yeah, you are absolutely right. If you, listeners, if you Google North Sea Jazz or go on northseajazz.com, then all of the listings there, tickets are there. So you can get involved. Fergus, thank you so much for coming on the Jazz Podcast. It's been amazing to sit and talk and find out about your music and your life and how it's all shaping up beautifully, I would say.
Oh, no worries at all. Thank you for having me. What a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to the Jazz Podcast. We're going to finish with another one of Fergus's tracks. This one is called Law Hill. This is also from his album of last year, Forest Floor. We will see you next week for some more Jazz Podcast action. Tell your friends, family, subscribe to us if you like what you hear, and we'll see you with Immy Churchill.